This is Free Speech Radio News for April 27th. I'm Bernard Wine. Pro-independentist Milo Djukanovic ekes out a victory in legislative elections in Montenegro. Students sit in at Harvard demanding a living wage for all Harvard employees. The Bush administration provides an incentive for oil exploration in the Gulf of Mexico. And a report on the People's Summit, which took place last weekend in Quebec City. Last weekend in Quebec City and around the hemisphere, citizens took to the streets to voice their concern about the Free Trade Area of the Americas, FTAA, which was being discussed at the Summit of the Americas by the heads of state of all the countries in the Western Hemisphere except Cuba. There were protests in over 200 cities around the hemisphere, and an estimated 60 to 80,000 people took to the streets of Quebec City. The protest activities ranged from a permitted march and rally to pushing over the security fence built around the area containing the summit and throwing rocks at the police. There was also a People's Summit, where citizens groups educated people and worked on coming up with a counterproposal to the FTAA, which focuses on human rights, the environment, and worker rights. Jade Padgett-Seekins reports from Quebec City.
Protest organizers divided the city up into three different segments, each for different tactics. The green areas were for street parties, theater, music, juggling, puppets, and other legal activities. The yellow area was for nonviolent direct action. The red area, near the security perimeter fence, was free-for-all tactics. Pretty early in the day on Friday, confrontation started in the red area. Some protesters threw rocks at the police, and plastic bullets were shot by authorities. One of the bullets hit a bystander in the throat, resulting in serious injury. Others were also injured by them, and some of the police ended up in the hospital as well. Some arrests were made. On Friday evening, I asked Rachel Shugart, an art student from Toronto, what her day had been like.
Around 12 or 1 o'clock, we started to rally together, and we started marching down René Levesque, one of the main streets. It was really, quite spectacular. There were so many people, and everyone was so cheerful, and, you know, beach balls in the air and stuff like that. And then we arrived at the Plains of Abraham. There was already riot police behind the wire, but there wasn't very much action going on, and we sort of sang and chanted for a while. Some people started to really shake the fence, and it was about to come down, so they started shooting tear gas at us. And after that, basically people were all up against the fence. And then we danced and stuff like that, and again the police fired into us, like this time without any provocation whatsoever.
On Saturday, activities around the security perimeter were much the same as they had been on Friday, although there were many more arrests. By the time the weekend was over, approximately 400 to 450 people had been arrested. There have been many complaints by the arrestees of mistreatment in jail. These include not being given food and water, being forced to take cold showers, and being denied a call to a lawyer for up to 12 hours after having arrived at the jail, and possibly longer. On Saturday, there was a permitted march, which organizers estimated 68,000 people attended, and marched away from the summit area to a huge parking lot at the edge of town. There are many union members there. I spoke with Steve Athey from the Communication, Energy, and Paper Workers Union about how the FTAA will affect unions and workers' rights.
Probably one of the biggest problems with these free trade talks is that they don't include strict rules and regulations, involving freedom to organize. And our union has had direct experience with that in Mexico and other places where we supported independent unions. And, very corrupt governments and organizations are working against the free organization of workers.
Wendy Menendez from Guatemala is part of Children of the Disappeared. She also works with other human rights issues. She spoke about what it is like to work in a maquiladora.
In the maquilas, the women have to work, they don't work 8-hour shifts, right? They work like 12, 16-hour shifts. And they're only allowed to go to the bathroom once. If you want to work for a maquila, they make a test if you're pregnant or not. They're paid in quetzales, they're paid an hour, like 1 quetzal an hour or something, 2 quetzales an hour. That's in the better places, in the better factories.
So how much does it cost to buy enough food to eat?
It depends. If you just want to get by a month, I would say about 800 quetzales. But of course, that's only food, right? You have to think about your housing, the water, getting around, right? Transportation, clothing, and if you have got children, milk, right? A liter of milk, instant milk, right? costs like 100 quetzales.
I spoke with a Quebec City resident about why he was out on the march with his young son.
I know that he's not understanding a lot of why we're here today, but I want him to know for the future that he has something to do. And even though it's a very small part of it, it's small steps that make things change.
The trade agreement is supposed to be completed by 2005, but the protesters say they will see that it is never ratified. This is Jade Paget-Seekins reporting from the Independent Media Center in Quebec City for Free Speech Radio News.
Although most of media did provide some attention to the protests in Quebec City, reportage about the People's Summit, which ran concurrently, was mostly excluded. The People's Summit held educational workshops and worked on a counterproposal to that of the Free Trade of the Americas. Stephen Cooperman filed this report on events in Quebec and how in the new broad economic configuration, some countries are more equal than others.
With much official fanfare, the heads of state at the Summit of the Americas approved the Democracy Clause, but notable also was who disagreed with the clause. The lone abstainer from the wording of the Democracy Clause was Venezuela's president, Hugo Chavez. He's tried to implement in Venezuela what he calls participatory democracy, making frequent use of popular consultations and referendums. It's a form of democracy that could be at odds with some of the official passages in the clause referring to representative democracy. But Venezuela is not likely to be hit with sanctions under the Democracy Clause because the country is a major supplier of high-quality petroleum to both Canada and the United States. And proof of the importance to the leaders at the summit of a secure energy supply was a U.S. proposal of a continental energy pact. After months of speculation, American President George W. Bush said he was seeking energy concessions more from Mexico than from Canada. Canada is already the largest exporter of oil, natural gas, and electricity to the United States. It exports more than $30 billion worth of these products across the border every year. Stephen Staples is with the Council of Canadians, Canada's largest citizens advocacy group, and one of the organizers of the largest protest march at the summit. He says there's a strong lesson Mexico can learn from Canada, the United States' largest and most secure energy supplier.
Canada has become integrated into the American market for oil and gas. We are unable to charge different prices for our own citizens, even though we're in a surplus here in the United States is in a shortage. Canadians are paying higher prices when we have lots of gas here. And so the crisis there is being imported here, and seniors aren't able to, weren't able to heat their homes.
But after summit developments, energy integration looks closer than ever. The three leaders of Canada, the United States, and Mexico set up a North American Energy Working Group, what they called a technical-level forum to improve communication on the issue. President Bush, himself a former Texas oilman, also suggested the United States would work to build even more pipelines to export oil from Canada. For Staples, the prospect is ominous.
Really, at this point, the sources of more oil and gas to feed this appetite in the United States is in environmentally sensitive areas. It's in the Northwest Territories. It's in the Rocky Mountains. It's on the East Coast, the Sable Island, places that drilling shouldn't be done. These are very environmentally sensitive areas, but in order to feed this insatiable appetite in the United States, and because of NAFTA, we're being driven to do a more explanation to feed the United States.
Feeding the United States more than oil was also on the summit agenda. The Canadian Prime Minister twice took the opportunity to feed the American President potatoes from Prince Edward Island. Potatoes from the Canadian province are presently banned from import into the United States. But despite haute cuisine and backroom meetings, the ban remains, as does a major and long-standing trade dispute over Canadian softwood lumber imports to the United States. As expected, this dispute, too, was not resolved at the summit. Staples again on the divergence of stance the United States has on the softwood lumber issue and its general stance on freer trade at the summit meeting.
They want their cake and eat it, too. That really what the position is of these people is that they're willing to negotiate these agreements as long as they benefit the United States and as long as they're the number one beneficiary of it.
Meanwhile, while cross-border trade disputes like the softwood lumber one play themselves out in the courts and in the corporate backrooms, many of the smaller groups protesting at the summit are looking to make progress of a different kind. Jennifer Auchinleck with a grassroots organization called Project Genesis, helping low-income Montrealers.
I think it's very important to be working at the very local level, on public education, public meetings, discussion. Even if it's a discussion of 15, 20 people, it's very, very important for the public to know what's going on and get access to information and find ways to get involved.
But like the multilateral trade discussions that took place at the summit, the so-called People Summit that took place before the official summit led to discussions from different countries as well. And it's with this spirit in mind that even local groups look towards the future.
There's, of course, all kinds of work at the coalition level, and that can mean Quebec-wide coalitions, Canada-wide coalitions, and it can mean the alliances that have been developed with groups across the states and in Central and South America. And so there's work to be done at that level as well, fostering the links, developing solidarity, and coming up with action plans that really cross the continent and are much, much stronger.
And yet, despite the protests, leaders from across North, South, and Central America still hope to finalize the full free trade area of the Americas by the year 2005. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Stephen Cooperman in Montreal, Canada.
Close to 10,000 women and men gathered in Washington Senate Park for the National Organization for Women's Emergency Action for Women's Lives. Capping off 2 weeks of lobbying senators during the congressional break, launching a virtual campaign for issues like pay legislation and the reversal of the gag rule. The rally and march sounded an urgent cry for women's reproductive health care. Miranda Kennedy, reporting from Washington.
Not the church, not the state. Women will decide our fate.
Sylvia Enriquez of the National Abortion Federation told the thousands assembled, many of whom were college-aged women, that Bush's attacks on women's rights and his allegiance with conservative Christian elements should put them on red alert.
Almost half the women in the U.S. will have an abortion. Bush is anti-choice, Congress is anti-choice, and then an anti-choice Supreme Court justice could be next. We want to make sure that Bush and Congress know that we, the pro-choice majority, are watching and monitoring the Supreme Court nomination process. We are only one vote away from losing Roe versus Wade.
Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who has been the crucial fifth vote in a 5-4 split court upholding Roe versus Wade, may step down as early as this summer. Bush is unlikely to nominate pro-choice justices to replace O'Connor or other anticipated retirees. Women's advocates are concerned that the enforcement of abortion laws, availability of contraception, insurance coverage for reproductive care, and funding for sex education will worsen over the next 4 years. But for those on the front lines of women's health care, clinic violence and harassment have long been in crisis. One abortion provider scheduled to speak at the rally asked someone else to read her statement for her, saying she was afraid for herself and her family after being targeted by anti-choice activists.
The gravest threat to a woman's right to choose abortion is the extinction of the abortion provider from intimidation. Women's rights are being attacked through attacking abortion doctors. Should we stand for abortion providers, including myself, having their photos and families' photos on internet hit lists and our home addresses? Should we stand for having flyers mailed to our entire neighborhoods saying that you should not allow your kids to play with mine since the furniture in my house is bought with the blood of dead babies?
Dr. James Pendergraft, an African-American late-term abortion provider who owns 5 clinics in Florida, spoke publicly for the first time about his federal conviction on charges of extortion, conspiracy, and mail fraud. Pendergraft's supporters say the conviction, which could put him in jail for up to 30 years, is about abortion, not extortion.
I am an abortion provider. I am an abortion provider in a town where the last clinic was burned to the ground. But women still needed services, so I decided to open a new clinic there. I am an abortion provider who wears a bulletproof vest to work. My clinic is a site of daily protest, and I fear for the physical safety for my patients, my employees, and myself.
Some have criticized the NOW action for a lack of diversity, bad publicity, and the timing of the rally, which collided with both the FTAA protests in Quebec City and Earth Day. According to NOW President Patricia Ireland, the timing was unfortunate but unavoidable. She said they were hoping to draw alliances across movement lines to show that women's reproductive choice is a social justice issue intimately connected to other fundamental freedoms. But until that happens, it's going to be a tough fight. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Miranda Kennedy in Washington.
Last Sunday, legislative elections were held in Montenegro with the victory going to pro-independentist Milo Djukanovic over the pro-Yugoslav SNP. However, the slim margin of victory has not given Djukanovic a clear mandate for a referendum on Montenegro's independence from the Serb-dominated Yugoslav Federal Republic. Rafael Kraft reports from Podgorica in Yugoslavia.
Yugoslavia! Contrary to all expectations, the pro-Yugoslav SNP supporters were the first to chant in the streets of Podgorica. Nevertheless, the victory is going to pro-independentist and President Milo Djukanovic. But the atmosphere is dull at his headquarters. His democratic coalition was not expecting such a close victory, which is now compromising the independence of the little republic. The streets of the Montenegrin capital, Podgorica, are full of honking cars. The flags people are waving at the windows are Serb, Yugoslav, but not Montenegrin. A few hours before, the atmosphere was calm in the polling stations. 3,000 local and foreign observers had been mobilized to check and approve the democratic procedure of the elections. But Milo Djukanovic did everything legal and illegal to ensure a victory to his party that would allow him to call for a referendum on the independence of the republic from Serb-dominated Yugoslav Federal Republic. In this polling station of Podgorica, the president admits it without concern. All the presidents of the polling station belong to Milo Djukanovic's party, DPS. On the other side of the poll, a member of the Liberal Party expresses the unfairness of the procedure.
It's a scandal because the president of the polling station belongs to the leading party. The Coalition for Yugoslavia and the Liberals have only one observer. They are represented by four people, and we are only two. Furthermore, we do not have mobile phones, cars, flour, or oil to distribute to the voters.
The day before the elections, 100 German marks were distributed to the workers of a washing machine factory in Cetinje. They had not received their salary for 6 months. Milo Djukanovic, who had received the support of the Muslim and Albanian minorities and his well-paid civil servants, did not manage to obtain an absolute majority in the parliament. Now he's caught in the crossfire of the strongly independentist liberals and Albanian parties. He's obliged allied to form a coalition government. And the international community, which does not dare to seek an independent Montenegro. Will Milo Djukanovic call for a referendum of independence? Jean-Arnaud Derains, author of numerous books on the Balkans, explains.
The president promised the referendum during the elections campaign, but now the problem is the following. Pro-Yugoslav opposition will not vote against independence of Montenegro, but will not take part of the vote, will boycott this referendum. So what will be the legitimacy of the referendum if only 51 or 52% of the citizens of Montenegro will take part of this referendum? The international community will not recognize this referendum, Belgrade will not too, and politically it will be surely very difficult to face the whole division of the country between the two blocs, pro-Serbian and independentist bloc, and to convince a large part of the Montenegrin population to build this project of independence of the country.
International diplomats say an independent Montenegro would result in the breakup of the Yugoslav Federation, opening the question of Kosovo's independence, a destabilizing factor for the fragile Balkan region. Today, the satisfying result of these elections for the international community leads to an internal political crisis in a Montenegro strongly divided in two blocs. Jean-Arnaud Derains, if this political crisis is not quickly solved, can it lead Montenegro to dangerous popular tensions?
Maybe. After the First World War, Montenegro experienced a harsh civil war between the white and the greens. The whites were the pro-Serbian-oriented people, and the green, the pro-Montenegrin, the pro-dynasty of Petrovic Njegoš-oriented people. Now, this division between greens and whites still existed, still is the same. The Montenegro is a clanic society, a tribal society. The political allegiances are conditioned by the clinic appartenances. Now, probably, some persons could have interest to go to hard political tension, to tension between the people. And it's very easy to lie the powder cake.
If a civil war is not on the Montenegrin agenda, it has to be watched carefully that some of the independentists are Muslim and sometimes live in a pro-Serb neighborhood, a configuration that could easily escalate in clashes. The international community has another card to lay on the table, the Hague Tribunal's secret list on Montenegro concerning the bombing of Croatian port Dubrovnik by Montenegro in 1991. A list on which many politicians and officers are filed, including perhaps President Milo Djukanovic. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rafael Kraft in Podgorica.
The Bush administration's hunt for new sources of oil and natural gas could pit the president against his brother Jeb and could have a disastrous effect on Florida's Gulf Coast. Last month, U.S. Interior Secretary Gail Norton notified Florida Governor Jeb Bush that she planned to proceed with a proposal to auction oil and gas development leases in a large tract along the east coast of the Gulf of Mexico, some of which comes within 30 miles of the western tip of the Florida Panhandle. Mitch Perry reports from Tampa.
Although virtually all Florida elected officials, starting with Governor Jeb Bush, for years have professed to be dead set against expanding the existing 100-mile moratorium on drilling for oil and gas off the Florida coast, it is by no means a certainty that their opposition will stop the George W. Bush administration from allowing new leases. That's because the congressional delegations from Louisiana, Alabama, and Mississippi support oil and gas exploration off the Gulf Coast. In fact, the entire Mississippi delegation sent a letter drafted by Senate Majority Leader Trent Watt urging the president to ignore Florida's opposition. In Newport Richey, Florida last October, Bush vowed he was against oil and gas drilling off the Florida coast.
I'm going to work with your governor about offshore drilling here in Florida. We're both against it.
Now some environmentalists and Florida Democrats say the president was lying when he made that campaign vow. But a White House spokesman says that all the president promised was to support the current 100-mile moratorium, and the proposed plan lies outside that circumference. That's because though the zone that federal officials plan to auction in December lies only 30 miles from Pensacola in northern Florida, it is in Alabama water west of the Florida state line. Beth Connors from the Suncoast Sierra Club based in St. Petersburg, which would be 213 miles away from the proposed new site known as Area 181. She's not buying the distinction of divided state lines.
I think that he's learned there's two ways to skin a cat, and they've drawn these artificial lines on a map that technically it starts south of Alabama, but it's only 30 miles from Pensacola Beach. And anyone who's been to any beaches in the Panhandle know that those are some of the most exquisite sugar sand, intact dune system beaches that we have.
This week, both Florida Democratic senators, Bob Graham and Bill Nelson, were expected to introduce a Senate bill establishing a moratorium on drilling in the Sale 181 area. On the Senate floor, Nelson blasted the apparent about-face by the president.
This lease track would come within some 20 to 30 miles from the pristine white beaches of the state of Florida. Now, I can tell you that 16 million Americans residing in the state of Florida do not want offshore oil drilling.
The possibility of the federal government allowing drilling for oil or gas off the Florida coast represents the first possible policy fissure in relations between the president and his younger brother. On Wednesday in Tampa, Jeb Bush was asked if he thought that drilling for oil off the coast of Florida could soon become a reality.
I hope not. I'm fighting hard to make sure that we don't. I'm lobbying all people from the top down to wherever it needs to be lobbied, and I can't tell you what the outcome will be, but I hope we prevail, and I believe we will.
Most political observers believe that perhaps the most important man to target will be C.W. Bill Young, the powerful congressman based in Largo, Florida, who is the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee. Mark Farillo from the Florida Public Interest Research Group says Young will be the public official who could have the most influence in Congress.
Congressman Young from Tampa Bay is one of the highest-ranking, most powerful members in government. He controls the purse strings to every agency, including the agency that wants to drill off our coast. So we need to bring that pressure to bear and defeat those efforts by the Gulf state delegations that want to open up our coast.
Young said last week that one possibility would be a compromise that would prohibit leases in the northern part of the site that is closest to Pensacola, but allow leases in the area that is farther out to sea. Beth Connor from the Sierra Club says that drilling off the Florida coast would crush tourism in that portion of the state, which would be detrimental to the Florida economy.
100% of our delegation for the last 15 years, both Republican and Democrat, are 100% opposed to offshore oil drilling. We know that the environment is the economy in Florida. The environment is our economy. And when they get it in their heads that you spoil it, nobody makes money. And we don't care about money. We want clean air and clean water.
Federal officials plan to auction Area 181 this December. Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, Tampa.
For the past 10 days, 47 Harvard students have been sitting in at University President Neil Rudenstein's office. They are protesting to demand a living wage for all of Harvard's employees. This action was taken after years of a student-run campaign for a living wage failed to be enacted. From Boston, Chuck Rosina has this report.
Since 1998, the progressive student labor movement has been waging a campaign for a living wage so that all Harvard employees can afford to live decently in their communities. The sit-in is an escalation of student pressure on the administration to enact such a policy. Massachusetts Hall, where this action is taking place, is surrounded by campus police. The 47 students have had no access to showers and share one bathroom. Only food has been allowed into the building. Even under these adverse conditions, spirits are high.
We intend to stay here until we win.
Did you expect to be there this long?
We really didn't know. I mean, we definitely...
We had a really flexible plan, and I think we certainly had enough bread and peanut butter to last us for a month or so.
Yeah. Frankly, though, what's been keeping us going is the food brought in by the workers, students, faculty, and just community supporters.
And I would say even besides, like, the physical food and nourishment that we receive from outside, it's really this, like, total spiritual, like, emotional, like, uplifting chance and just physical presence that we get from the outside.
This is just amazing. I'm really, really happy with the Harvard community. I think that the community has redeemed itself. Now it's up to the administration to follow suit.
Sarah and Madeline, two of the occupying students, leaning out of a window to share their thoughts with those of us on the outside. In front of the building, there have been round-the-clock vigils and daily rallies. A multitude of tents have sprung up in Harvard Yard, where protesters have been camping out to show their support for those inside the building. Michael Hirschfeld is an anthropology professor at Harvard and one of the growing number of faculty in support of the student sit-in.
Where, then, is this famous dignity? Is dignity standing in a three-piece suit in the faculty club? I wear a tie, so? And living off a plate of hors d'oeuvres that probably costs more than any one of the people we're here trying to help would earn in a whole day. Is that dignity?
No!
Harvard may say, we are an important place, which is true, and for that very reason, I answer, we have an emblematic responsibility. We cannot simply rest on those laurels of old. If we wish to gain laurels today, those will be laurels in the fight for social justice.
Most of the Massachusetts congressional delegation, including Senators Kennedy and Kerry, have endorsed the students' demands. So have many labor unions in Cambridge City Council. Janice Locks is an organizer from the Service Employee Industrial Union Local 26.
How wealthy is Harvard? We know it. $19.2 billion endowment. That's more than Yale. That's more than Princeton. That's more than the University of Pennsylvania. Harvard University, $2.1 billion operating budget. It's more than it takes the entire city of Cambridge to run its budget. It's more than it takes the entire city of Boston to run its budget. With all this money, Harvard wants us to believe that they can't afford to pay a living wage. They're full of something.
Administration officials have refused comment on tape, but Joe Rinn, university spokesperson, stated in print, quote, "We're not going to speak to them while they're occupying a building," unquote. University police have been working double shifts. There have been no negotiations, so as of yet, there is no end in sight. Students say they are determined to stay for the long haul.
We shall not be moved just like a tree that's standing by the water. We shall not be moved.
For Free Speech Radio News, I am Chuck Rosina in Harvard Yard, Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. Over 40 reporters on four continents and in 14 states are on strike against Pacifica Network News for its censorship of legitimate news stories. These reporters are putting their livelihoods on the line. They need your support. For information, go to the strike's website at www.savepacifica.net/strike. I'm Bernard White.